Hello, everyone, and welcome to ESIB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I am pleased to welcome Stuart Hobinson to the podcast to talk about trade, the Trump tariffs, the World Trade Organizations, and discussions about whether the World Trade Organization can be revived through reform. It is certainly a busy time for trade right now. We are recording this on July the 4th, which means we are just a few days away from the deadline that the Trump administration established for new trade negotiations. So in theory, countries that have not signed new trade agreements with the United States will soon face the full force of the so-called Liberation Day tariffs. And while some countries seem to have clinched deals with the US, many countries have not. So this is what we're going to talk about today. And there are a few people with so much insight and experience on all matters related to trade as Stuart Hobinson. We are very proud to have him associated with us as senior fellow. He has held very many senior positions in the World Trade Organization Secretariat. And before that, he represented Hong Kong as ambassador to the WTO. He chaired the General Counsel of the WTO when it launched the Doha Round. And after leaving the WTO, he moved to UNCTAD, where he joined forces again with Dr. Supachai, as he also moved to the UN organization from the WTO. Stuart, you are very welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Frederick. And it's a real pleasure to be joining you here today.
Well, thank you, Stuart. And we are going to start our conversation on the basis of an essay that you wrote for us about a week ago and that we also are going to link to in the show notes. And it's one that I recommend people with an interest in trade policy to read because it points to a number of issues of growing concern and not just the Trump tariffs. But let us start with the Trump tariffs. The economic aspects of them are one part. And of course, the entire world has spent a lot of energy discussing them since early April, when the Liberation Day, as it was called, was announced. But I'm curious about their effect on the international trading system. Here we have a leading country with systemic importance for the WTO, who seems to end up with an extraordinary messy tariff schedule. Other countries have negotiated or are negotiating with the United States, and the result is that the United States will get favors that other countries won't. It is true that many countries have for a long time slid away from the most favored nation principle, but the process now and over the past months are a giant step in this direction. So, Stuart, how do you think this is going to affect the international trading system?
Well, good question, Frederick. Starting with an easy one, I guess. Yes, you're absolutely right. You put your finger on it there that benchmark principle of the trading system and the World Trade Organization is the MFN principle, under which you can, it's a treaty provision, which means that one state or economy undertakes to accord to another state or economy treatment no less favorable than it accords to any other state or economy. And this has been the bedrock of the world trading system for many years. And its major virtues are, first of all, non-discrimination. Everybody gets treated the same. And secondly, predictability. Everybody knows what the tariff rate or trade treatment will be. Of course, this is not the first instance of moving away from MFN. We have legal means of doing so, actually, under the WTO, because there are preferential trade agreements, regional trade agreements, customs unions, etc., which are a legal derogation, but they are subject to certain conditions, such as the trade restrictiveness should not be any greater than it was in the past, and that the agreement should cover substantially all the trade. Subject to that, you can have an FTA or a trade agreement with, with another country. And indeed, we've seen a proliferation of those agreements over the last 20, 25 years. You also correctly said that, an issue with all of these bilateral deals, which appear to be in the offing, and we've already had the US-UK agreement, and there's a lot of speculation in the media about where the next deals are coming from. But it means that the US will get favors that others won't. And maybe this is something that we don't like but have to learn to live with. But the huge danger is that it leads to a sort of downward spiral. And that so if I am jealous of you because you've got away into the US, and in return for that, you have given the US preferential treatment, thereby affecting my exports, then I'm likely to look for some form of retaliation. And this can get out of hand. It hasn't done so yet, but it's a real danger. I was very pleased to see recently the launch of this trade dialogue between the European Union and the CPTPP members, because these are two groups of economies which are very much reliant on the trading system and very much strong supporters of the global trading system. So maybe they can work something out, but it won't be easy because there are some countries in the CPTPP who will be very anxious to do deals with the US. And in fact, one, the UK has already done that. But still, there is some hope there, I think. But the point I was making in the blog basically is that at present we're in this rather unsatisfactory situation where of a really a contradiction that in Geneva and at the WTO, everyone is still professing support for the global trading system. But then the reality, the economic reality, is that they have to save themselves and do a deal with the US. So it's just to finish on that, it's an extremely volatile and unpredictable trading environment at present.
Indeed. Coming back to the MFN principle before going into some of the other issues you just raised, Stuart. So this is not just one principle among many. It's actually a very, very important principle. And there is a reason for why it is enshrined in sort of the core articles of the various type of WTO agreements, and of course was also a core part of all the treaties that have been established around international trade agreements. Sometimes you hear references to the MFN principle, but you think that perhaps people haven't understood the significance of it and why it's so important. So if we just take a step back to it and ask the question, why is the MFN principle so important?
I think we can learn some lessons from history here. I'm not one of those who thinks that history repeats itself, but certainly we can learn a lot from history. And of course, I think the MFN principle, as a principle, goes back quite a long way. But it's really since the beginning of the 20th century that we've seen such a significant development in relation to that. And of course, we had the Great Depression in 1929, which led to the passing of the what was called the Smoot-Hawley Act in the US in 1930. And the aim of that act, which raised tariffs on, I think, about 20,000 products, if my memory serves me correctly, was to boost domestic employment and to also boost domestic manufacturing. In other words, very much the sort of idea that President Trump seems to have in mind right now. But unfortunately, it had the opposite effect. It made the Depression worse, and it provoked retaliation, particularly in the form of imperial preferences by Great Britain. And then I think Cordell Hull in the 1930s had the bright idea, the extremely bright idea, that we need to get away from this, have a level playing field, a non-discriminatory situation. And he was the one really that moved this through under FDR and the New Deal and all of that. And there was the Reciprocal Tariff Act in the, I think about 1934 in the US, which gave the president authority to reduce tariffs, US tariffs, where a trade deal could be done with another country incorporating the MFN principle. So that's the kind of background. So in a way, it looks like history's repeating itself. I don't believe it is, because things are never exactly the same. But nevertheless, there is a lesson that I think we need to absorb from that.
Indeed, yes. And like you, I don't think history repeats itself, and I don't want to be an historical determinist either. But of course, there are themes and there are rhymes through history which tend to return every now and again in history. And this is one of them. And to build on what you also said, Stuart, the systemic governance, the architecture point around MFN, I think is extraordinarily important, because if you go back to that episode or previous episodes for that matter, when you find that countries are being put in very, very disadvantageous positions simply because there are other deals that are being made. So then you get second round effects, and then you begin to get third round effect and fourth round effects, and gradually you're going to move into a territory where you basically lose the ability to have any meaningful market economy based trade relations at all. I mean, it's just bilateral flows you end up managing in one way or the other. And I think that is one of the lessons from history. And it's also one of the lessons that it's not just immediate protectionism that have provoked gunboat diplomacy, or that you have resorted to more violent measures in order to sort of manage the fact that you have trade frictions. That has also happened in second and third round order effects as well. And then I think you can also add the economic aspect to it. And something we have also learned from history, which is that many of the benefits of trade, they do actually arise when you open markets to everyone. It's not when you clinch bilateral type of deals. They tend to quite often reallocate existing trade more than they generate a lot of new trade. So if the principle is that we're just reallocating trade from one bilateral relation to another bilateral relation, then after a while, you are going to find that the benefits from trade, they are not very strong. And people are going to start to question, why do we have these agreements at all, when the only thing we're doing is just shuffle around trade between different countries?
I totally agree. And in fact, I read something recently that under the GATT and WTO system, relying, as we all know, on MFN, I think the volume of world trade between 1950 and 2024, something like that, multiplied 45 times on a value basis, and much, much higher than that on, sorry, I beg your pardon, on a volume basis, and much, much more than 45 times on a value basis. So, you know, that I think the system has served the world well as whilst not being perfect at all, lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, which is a huge, huge accomplishment.
Indeed. One of the great accomplishments of the last 30, 40 years is the amazing reduction of poverty in the world, and trade has been extraordinarily influential in shaping that outcome. Now, Stuart, so if we think now, so the member of the WHO that is now turning in this direction is not any member. It's actually a very, very important member. I mean, you went back to Cordell Hull and the establishment and principles. And of course, despite the the immediate complications that existed after the Bretton Woods Agreement in order to establish a multilateral, at least the first basis of a multilateral trading system with support from the US Congress. It is the fact that America has played an outsized role for shaping the multilateral system ever since basically 1947 up till now. So it's a very, very important country that is now deciding to go in a different way. And that is, of course, leaving any other member. And of course, it's also leaving the institution in itself in a very, very strong predicament, because what can it do if one very important member decides to go in a different direction? But thinking then about the sort of second round problems that are coming to the WTO as a consequence of that, do you think there is a role here, or do you think the Secretariat can be active in type of sort of trying to manage the sort of the fallout from what Trump is doing and the negotiations that they have with, that other countries have with America, to avoid that we are going to have a stronger rush into sort of a free-for-all type of system? Is there something the Secretariat and the institution can do, of course, in conjunction with other initiatives that have been taken? Is there something they can do?
Yes, I mean, another really, really excellent question. Of course, in the WTO, some of the listeners may be familiar with the fact that there's a sort of a mantra in the WTO that it is a quote unquote member driven organization. Some people say with dark humor that it's being member driven over a cliff, actually, but we won't go into that. But the Secretariat has a somewhat limited role in the WTO. That has been clear from the beginning. And there's no one more vigilant in that respect than the US. The US recently, in fact, circulated a paper in the WTO saying just that the Secretariat was doing too much, and that every move that it made had to be agreed by the members. But having said that, I think, you know, that's a US point of view, and there would be others that might subscribe to that as well. But there's a huge body of opinion in the World Trade Organization, particularly amongst what you might call the middle ground countries, as well as developing countries, that you know, they regard the Secretariat and the Director General as custodian of their interests, because you know, in a pure power game, then a lot of the smaller countries will be completely lost, and they see the Director General as the guardian of their interests, so they would be very happy to see the Secretariat becoming more active. It's a very difficult role for the Director General to play, to navigate between all of these different currents of opinion. But you know, the Director General is an honest broker. He or she is not following the orders of any particular member or group of members, and so you know, he or she must play a major role.
Indeed, and I suppose there are things that can be done in various ways in order to just be helpful to the larger membership of the organization. I mean, the first one, of course, that comes to mind is to just be a good provider of analysis and a good provider of basically being a resource to make sure that it is clear to everyone what agreements there are out there, what they say, what they cover, and the extent to which they do have an impact on other countries, which is basically purely a research and analysis function rather than something else. We have seen with the establishment of alternative and new dispute resolution mechanisms that came during the first Trump administration, that there is also a knowledge transfer, which is can be quite significant in order to quickly establish frameworks, in this case outside the framework of the WTO itself, in order to be helpful to members that are seeking more constructive ways in order to resolve disputes in this case. And a third one, of course, is that what you pointed to, we have a significant body of the membership, also mid-sized economies. I mean, sometimes they are pretty big economies that do have a systemic interest to protect the relevance of the institutions. And here we have a lot of the Europeans, we have many of the Asian countries, we have Latin American and also African countries that have already declared an interest to make sure in the first place that we also do take steps to protect the institution itself. You referred to the comment that we can hear coming out from Berlaymont in Brussels a few days ago, with Commission President Ursula von der Leyen signaling that there is an interest on the part of Europe to have conversations with CPTPP, not just about the typical stuff that you have contacts about when you discuss trade, which is market access issues, but also to talk about some of the systemic, perhaps the rules and the architecture that we need to think about as we move forward. What do you think can come out of such type of initiatives? I mean, Europe and CPTPP, they are pretty significant economic areas in themselves. So this is not just anybody talking. Do you think that adds some extra strength and some extra perhaps excitement to the initiative, that it's sort of quite a lot of GDP behind, quite a lot of trade behind the countries that are members in these two bodies?
Absolutely. Yes, I totally agree on that. I mean, I think, we shouldn't expect too much. Clearly, this is not going to evolve, I think, into a free trade agreement between the two blocks, if I can call them that, although TPP is not really a bloc. But I don't think we're going to see an institutional or legal tie-up. But what they can do is coordinate their efforts to bolster the multilateral trading system and perhaps develop some sort of a code of conduct or something like that, which they would agree to adhere to in terms of their relations with each other and with other countries as well. So I think it's a very interesting initiative. It's not easy. I mean, I was just reading the Financial Times this morning. I'm not trying to po point the finger at anyone, but it is a case in point that Vietnam is trying to do a deal with the US and is very dependent on trade with the US for its exports. So you can understand that. Now, Vietnam is also in the CPTPP, so that potentially is not an easy thing to square. But of course, this is just, I'm not trying to point the finger at anybody. I must emphasize it's just a handy example of the sort of situation that might arise.
Absolutely. And Vietnam is not the only country, even if it may be a country which is in an extremely difficult position since of its proximity to China and its, of course, economic linkages to China, and then having so much of its final foreign sales in America. So it's a complicated one. But I assume also, and this is what I understood von der Leyen to be pointing to, which is that, well, of course we have all the market access issues and we have the second round effect of the Trump agreements. How are they going to play out? But we also have a pretty strong body of rules that we need to discuss, and these rules may be covering the sort of enforcement or the implementation or the application of what we've already agreed on in the World Trade Organization, how that's going to be reflected now, given that the system itself has received such a strong sort of elbow from one of its major members. We have a lot of new rules issues that we need to talk about as well. We've seen, especially in the Asia Pacific region, a lot of innovation on the digital trade issues, the evolution of new type of agreements between countries like Singapore, New Zealand, and others. We have, of course, questions around, and this may be more relevant for Europe than for others, but we have questions around the boundaries and how do you dock different type of climate policy measures with trade rules. Also more of a rule issue than it is, I think, a market access issue. And finally, we have the national security issues that we should try to find a way to straighten these rules up a bit, to make them a bit more predictable and a bit less open-ended than what we have right now. So I would imagine that there is an opportunity here to have both rules discussions about all the new issues.
Yes, again, I totally agree with you there. I mean, one of the valid criticisms of the WTO is that it's not been able to modernize to keep its rules up to date with commercial and technological developments. Of course, it's a big ask if you've got 166 members at many, many different stages of development. Very, very hard. But the WTO should at least be addressing these issues, and it provides a very good forum for discussing international cooperation and where the boundaries of that might be in the short and medium term. So they should certainly be paying more attention to this. Of course, it's related in a way to the other conundrum of decision making in the WTO because, unfortunately, we've got ourselves into a position whereby one or two countries or a small group of countries can use this type of issue, i.e., developing new rules, to get their way on the old rules, if you like, in terms of trying to renegotiate things. I mean, they may not really object to moving into these new areas. But they see a tactical advantage in not allowing that to go ahead and to use that as leverage. Having said that, I mean, let's not put too much on the WTO. I think typically it has evolved by incremental movements. I think the latest on that was, fisheries subsidies a couple of years ago, which the negotiations continue. So hopefully they'll ratchet it up another notch in due course as well. And then occasional lurches forward or backwards, like the Uruguay round or the Doha round for that matter. I think you can't expect a smooth process in the WTO, put it that way, but they should certainly be addressing these issues.
No, and here I should also confess sort of at least a bias which I've been cured of in recent time, which is of course that my own generation entering this field in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, of course we thought that we had entered a period, and perhaps we read history in the wrong way as well. We thought that the history of GATT and what was to become the World Trade Organization was all about big, all-encompassing rounds where you're going to achieve a lot in one go. When the reality, of course, through history, which is that it's a long slog with gradual movements, hopefully mostly in the right direction, but sometimes it's also a few movements in bad directions as well. But that's the reality, and perhaps this is the mental model we should have for our current times as well. But you pointed to one of the issues which have been at least packaged under the headline WTO reform. And this is also what you discuss in your great essay now, Stuart. So I hear a lot of people talking about WTO reform. I've heard a lot of people talking about WTO reform, but I'm not so sure that we all have the same definition of what we mean when we say WTO reform. So what is your broad take on what is it? What do we mean when we say WTO reform?
Yes, well, my perspective on that is that there's a list of very important issues which people, countries generally agree form the agenda for WTO reform, but they all have vastly different priorities. So, for example, there's the question of decision making, which we've talked about a little bit, updating the rules. And in terms of making progress, how do you cope with a situation where 166 members are operating by consensus? And then for others, it's dispute settlement, which is the main issue, and reconstituting the appellate body. For the US, it's not reconstituting the appellate body, and it's putting the dispute settlement system in a kind of box so that it doesn't go too far down the judicial path. Then for others, it's all about development and providing proper policy space for developing countries to do their own thing without being constrained too much by the multilateral rules. And then for others, I think, yet others, it's how can we appease the US to keep them on board? There are probably a lot of countries out there that are willing to pay a price for that because they think in the long run it would be beneficial. I think the US is kind of in a fortunate position of having of being able to sit back and watch this unfold. I don't know how active they're going to be in terms of WTO reform. They will certainly have their red lines. And consensus will be one of their red lines because that is their veto. Of course, others have a veto too, but the US is always very keen on that. So, in short, the membership has got this menu of issues, but the emphasis varies considerably.
And do you think there is one or several of these items on the menu where you think, all right, here we have something to work with, and there may be opportunities going forward? I mean, I take it that it's going to be difficult to do something on decision making. You refer to the old Sutherland report in USA. We had a couple of other initiatives too, going 15, 20 years back in time, like the Warwick Commission report, which were all suggesting some type of qualified majority voting, etc. But all that sounded a bit difficult even before we ended into the really difficult territory we are in now. So I struggle to see where this can, the extent to which you can actually move things here. But are there others where you think that, yeah, there are some opportunities here to take to the full membership where they can start to at least have meaningful conversations about how to change things?
Yes, well, there are members of the WTO countries which feel that the whole system needs to be radically overhauled. There's much talk about deep reform. I myself, I'm not so sure how far that's likely to go, at least in the short and the medium term. But there is even on a modest view, there are some things that could be done. I think I mentioned in the blog that there could be something done about this tactical hostage taking of issues. At least we could do something to inhibit that sort of move. Also we need to look, I think, at plurilateral agreements again, because these offer a path forward. And for example, there's an agreement on investment facilitation for development. And it's supported by the overwhelming majority of members. I think I can't remember the latest count, 130, something like that, or 140. And this is not infringing on anyone else's rights. So why not attach it to the WTO as a as a plurilateral agreement, and then there's some sort of institutional framework that can monitor it and implement it and all of that. So that sort of thing I think is important. Even dispute settlement, I think there are some things that could be done to improve the situation. Perhaps not the appellate body, that may be a bridge too far at present, but there are certain things that could be done in terms of streamlining the processes, because even now the panel process takes a tremendous amount of time, and a lot could be done to speed that up, I think. And there is a certain amount of common ground in that regard, it's possible that could happen as well. I mean, there are other harder issues like the US view on state capitalism and subsidies. Those are hard rules which will be tough. China has said it's willing to discuss, but it's also indicated that it's got its red lines there. And then there's the whole I issue which the US raises of self-designation of developing countries. There's no kind of objective benchmark in the WTO as to what's a developing country. You're a developing country if you say you are. And the US has pointed its finger at that. There's an awful lot of things to discuss. I think probably what's going to happen is that the members of the WTO are going to discuss all of this over the next 6 months or so, and maybe try to refine an agenda, a reform agenda, which can be launched at the next ministerial conference in March 2026.
Which is also, if I'm right, is that also when there's also going to be a new director general for the WTO who will be
Think that should be
elected
later.
then? Is that later? All right, okay.
Yeah.
Well, but anyway, it basically means that there is an opportunity to at least restart the conversation in a structured way, which can point to some of these particular issues that you raised here. And to end the conversation, going back to dispute settlement, since this was also, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was, I mean, it was certainly one of the irritations that Robert Lighthizer came in with when he became the United States Trade Representative for America under the first Trump administration. But of course, that issue has a longer history in America, and he was not the first one to raise it. My understanding of the reactions when America started to block the re sort of or the appointments of new appellate body members was that other countries were frustrated, and they in the first place didn't share many of the concerns that America had. But it seems to me that more and more countries have at least joined that part of the bandwagon, which is that the overarching analysis is that perhaps the legalization of rules went a bit too far. If we think about dispute settlement as a swing between diplomacy as a method on the one hand and law as a method on the other hand, many countries seem now to be in a broad agreement that we swung too far towards law, and we should go sort of a little bit, perhaps not a little bit, but we should go back to a more diplomatic method for resolving disputes. Is that also how you interpret it, where members are?
Yes, I think in general terms that's correct, Frederick. There is a sort of general acceptance, I would say, that the WTO dispute settlement system has become over-legalized or over-judicialized, or had become over-judicialized, should I say, because we don't have an appellate body now. But there are differences of emphasis there. I think my reading would be that the European Union would be towards the more legalistic side of the spectrum, but still taking the point that the appellate body should not go too far, and then there would be others who would be much more to the US side and say that this is not what we agreed to when we set up the dispute settlement system in the WTO. We envisaged that It would be settling disputes, not just issuing judgments on all sorts of things that hadn't been fully negotiated in the Uruguay round or thereafter. I mean, I think you're right. There's kind of a feeling that that maybe the appellate body went too far, but it's not. But it's a question of degree, and the matter of degree is important to to resolving that issue.
Oh, indeed, yes, indeed. It cannot be about destroying the appellate body, because you need to have an appellate system if you want to be able to actually settle disputes and resolve them. And you also need to have a trusted body who will have the final say about what is it that members have agreed to in the agreement, and that's an important part. But I suppose the at least one of the criticisms, and this I've been also hearing from lawyers in the European Commission, which, as you said, tended to be on the more legalistic side of the argument, which is that they're concerned about that new rules were created through the appellate body, that absence agreements on issues in WTO agreements, someone had to say something about what should apply, and perhaps they said a little bit too much about how rules should be interpreted. I don't know if that's a correct representation of the issue or not, but I did find it interesting that even people who are on the legalistic side had some reservations about what happened a few years ago.
That's entirely correct. I think it's a good way to describe it. Of course, the WTO consists of agreements on all sorts of things. It'd be subsidies and countervailing measures, or import licensing, or customs valuation, all of these things. These are the results of negotiations. An expert or a lawyer has not sat down and said, I'm going to draft the perfect instrument. So there are lots of grey areas, and the whole point of not the whole point, but a major point in terms of dispute settlement was that the system should not add to or diminish the rights of their members. So some members would say, well, that is a grey area in that agreement, and that's what I negotiated. I don't want somebody else coming along now and telling me what it means. If it's a grey area, maybe the appellate body should have thrown it back at the members and said, you need to sort this out. And it would be fair to the appellate body, they were put there to hear cases between countries and make a decision. So, what I'm saying is has to be taken with a certain amount of nuance. But then probably was, were occasions when the appellate body went too far. But the other
No.
interesting thing, perhaps, sorry, if I can just
Sure.
get this in for a moment, is this multi-party interim arbitration arrangement, the so-called MPIA, which the EU was instrumental in setting up. And and initially some countries stayed out. It's been reasonably successful in the one or two cases that it's dealt with so far. There are certainly more cases coming down the line. For example, China and Canada are both subscribed to this arrangement, and there are some cases that are working through the system there. But the interesting thing was that in the last 2 or 3 months, both the UK and Japan have said that they're joining. So this is, it seems to have a little bit of gathering momentum. I mean, these are major economies in the world, and so that's quite a signal, I think, if Japan and the UK are coming on board for this.
I think you're absolutely right. And it may be a good time to also close this conversation, because that's an optimistic note. And we want to close on an optimistic note, which is, of course, that America and Trump, they are not representative of the entire world. Actually, most of the WTO members remain Very supportive of the institution, very supportive of the rules, very supportive of international trade in accordance with basic multilateral rules. And you can sometimes, you know, you also have to be a bit inventive and trying to find new alternatives or parallel ways of addressing things. And the multi-party arbitration institution, I think, is one of them. And hopefully it's going to be that bedrock of the system that we need when we don't have functioning dispute resolution in the WTO. All right, very good. Thank you so much, Stuart. It's been lovely talking to you. And also thank you for the brilliant essay, which I, as I said initially, we are going to link to in the show notes. It's also directly available on our websites. And then we just need to hold our breath as we're getting closer to July 9 and see if global trade, or at least America's participation in global trade, is going to take another major hit. And if we're back into that territory that we were in the first week of April, when we were all thinking that, my God, the sky is falling down. We'll see. Thank you so much, Stuart.
Thanks, Frederick. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.